Welcome to the AFMAN podcast with myself, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall. The AFMAN podcast seeks to illuminate and explore how traders succeed in financial markets by understanding the mindset, behavior, and psychology that underlies great risk-taking performance. At the core of all great risk-taking performance is the quality of the decisions we make, particularly decision-making when faced with uncertainty, volatility, and time-limited situations. Traders and investment professionals live and die by the quality of the decisions and choices they make in the moment. Today, we are delighted and honored to have on the show Dr. Gary Klein, who's possibly the world's leading expert in the study of how people make decisions in the moment when faced with uncertainty and the role of intuition in decision-making. Dr. Klein is a cognitive psychologist who could be credited with having found an entirely new field of study, naturalist decision-making, which explores this fascinating area and which has led to some powerful new tools and approaches to help improve and enhance people's decision-making skills, particularly in life and death situations. In this talk, we will look at, amongst other things, how the pre-mortem tool improves decision-making, developing expert decision-making using the shadow box method, the recognition prime decision-making model, which captures how experts make decisions, the role of intuition and pattern recognition in decision-making, learning how to use AI tools to aid decision-making, the naturalist decision-making approach to behavioral finance when compared to the biases and heuristics approach. We also talk about how experienced traders develop the ability to recognize patterns intuitively, which enable them to anticipate price moves in a way which even machines haven't yet learnt or been able to mimic. Later on, Dr. Klein also shares some fascinating stories from his years in the field, told in his own inimitable style. Before we start, we would like to thank our sponsor partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA are one of the world's leading organisations for the advancement of technical analysis and the study of price action. Membership of the STA opens up a world of amazing educational programmes, accredited diplomas, and provides access to talks, seminars, webinars, and regular newsletters and publications. You can apply to become a member of the STA by visiting their website, sta-uk.org. Their membership is open globally, not just for UK members. Also, if you are keen to learn about and improve your technical analysis skills, the STA provides an outstanding home study course written by some of the leading figures in the world of technical analysis. I would highly recommend this program, which has been put together based on decades of experience and know-how by experts who have been at the coalface of financial markets. Finally, before we start the podcast, why don't you check out the Alpha Mind Trader Performance Coaching Program? The program focuses on helping people develop and improve the key risk skills and psychological factors which contribute to trading performance mastery and helps people unleash the potential they have within them. This program makes use of our unique and powerful Human Alpha Performance Model, which helps illuminate the human aspects of the risk process and in turn allows people to make specific changes and adjustments in a process facilitated by the coach, which drives growth in risk capability and personal performance. This program has been delivered to people at many of the world's leading trading firms, including Bank of America Merrill Lynch, TD Securities, Balyasny Asset Management, Credit Suisse, National Australia Bank, Societe Generale, Danske Bank, SEB, Swedbank, Cargill's, Gazprom, Millennium Investments, Norges Bank Investment Management, Schroders Investment Management, Janus Henderson, Capula Investment Management, Caxton Associates, and many other leading firms. To know about the program, go to the AlphaMind blog, where the link at the top of the page provides further details of the coaching program. Alternatively, email info@alpharcubed.com. That's the word alpha, the letter R, and the word cubed.com. Or DM us on Twitter at AlphaMind101 with your email address. Or check out this podcast episode links on our blog or on the iTunes or whichever service you use. Thank you very much. Now on with the podcast.
Welcome to this week's Alpha Mind podcast, and we're delighted to have this week Dr. Gary Klein, PhD from macrocognition.com, and I think we're looking to have a real deep dive into some of the things that I know Steve has used over the years to guide his way through the financial markets coaching process. So Gary, welcome, and we'd love to hear a bit more about your story, your background. I know you've got some things you'd like to promote during this brief hour with ourselves, and we're intrigued to hear more. So over to you, Gary.
Okay, well, thank you both very much for inviting me onto this podcast. I do appreciate it, and I have no idea where this discussion is going to lead, but I think we'll learn something about what we have to offer to each other, and about, you know, some new kinds of ideas and approaches to the area of financial management and investment. And I would just like to tell you a little bit about how I got into this area. I'm a cognitive psychologist. I study how people make very difficult decisions under time pressure and uncertainty. And I started out working with firefighters. I started out working with firefighters needing to make life and death decisions. And at the time, there was standard decision models about how they're supposed to proceed. And those models weren't going to apply under the kind of time pressure that and uncertainty that firefighters were facing. So the question was, how do they really do it? And the only way to find out was to ride with them, stay over in fire stations with them, watch them in action, and interview them about tough cases. And this was back in around 1985. So this is, you know, a long time ago. And we discovered that the standard models didn't apply. And the models didn't apply because the models were very rational, very analytic, but they didn't have any room for expertise. And the firefighters had lots of expertise. And so they didn't have to go through careful establishing matrices to see what are my options and what are the evaluation criteria. They didn't have the time to do that. They didn't have the need to do that. They could draw on their expertise to know what was an appropriate course of action, and then they could imagine carrying it out and seeing if it would work or not. And that's what, and we call that a recognition-primed decision. And it's a combination of intuition and analysis. And the intuition is the patterns that you've built up over 5, 10, 20 years of practice that lets you rapidly size up a situation. The analysis part is when you do the mental simulation to see, will it work in this type of situation? And so we've been studying people like firefighters ever since then, and the decades since. We've studied, we have projects going on now with law enforcement, child protective services, social workers, caseworkers working with children who need to be cared for, and petrochemical plant panel operators and groups like that. Certainly we've done a lot of work with the military. So, but the core focus that sets our work apart from standard decision-making research is the nature of expertise and the importance of expertise, the importance of developing it and applying it, and applying it even for financial decision-making, because you certainly don't want to be, you know, purely emotional about making these kinds of decisions. But you're talking about people who are specialists, who've gained a lot of experience. And you want to make sure that they can, that you respect their experience and you can draw on it and use that experience. And we've found several ways of doing that. Shall I describe some of those ways to you?
Yes, I'd love to hear that.
Okay, so one of the techniques that we developed that we've seen some application in financial services is a technique called a pre-mortem. And it's a technique for doing essentially risk assessment. But instead of saying, here's a course of action, is this reasonable? You know, do we like it? Well, yes, we do. No, we don't. And people sometimes get caught up in these things. You want to be able to assess it, but how do you do the assessment? And you have various kinds of risk analysis techniques, but the pre-mortem is different from most of the, just about all the other techniques. And it wasn't originally developed for financial services. And I was sort of intrigued to find out that it's being used in that area. The pre-mortem is a technique for letting the group of people who are working together draw on their own experience to identify possible problems. Here's how a pre-mortem works. You're all familiar with a post-mortem. Post-mortem, you have a patient, patient dies, you do an autopsy, find out what went wrong, and then you report it to the people involved. And so the physician has learned what was really wrong with the patient, so the physician benefits, and the team of healthcare workers benefits. The family benefits because they find out what went wrong. And if there's something that's unique and noteworthy, you might write about it so the whole community learns. So everybody benefits from a post-mortem. Everybody except the patient because the patient is dead. So we wondered, you know, we would do projects in my company and we would do a post-mortem if a project went poorly. And we said, why don't we do these at the beginning? And maybe we can have a higher success rate. And so the way the pre-mortem works is we have our kickoff meeting. We usually do it as a part of a kickoff meeting for a new project, but you could do it around, you know, decisions about making an investment choices and things, judgments and things like that. And you have your plan of action and you say, okay, now that we're all clear about what we're planning to do, we'll do a pre-mortem. And everybody around the table, just lean back, just take a few minutes here, and imagine that we have a crystal ball on the table, and we're looking in the crystal ball to see what happened if we made this decision, if we chose this course of action, if we accepted this plan. And we're looking in the crystal ball, and oh, what we see is not pretty. This has failed. It's failed in a major way. This has been a disaster. So the crystal ball is telling us that this decision worked out very, very poorly. We know that, but we don't know why. Now, everybody around the table, take 2 minutes and write down, each of you, write down all the reasons you can think of for why this plan failed. And then everybody does that. And you just wait and you time it carefully for 2 minutes. And when the 2 minutes are up, you say, okay, now we're going to go around the room and find out what people wrote. And that's the way the pre-mortem works. And you're able to draw on the collective wisdom of the people in the room. You can draw on people who've been doing this for a long time, who've seen it all, and now they can apply their experience to this particular decision. And you can draw on newer people who may have some new ideas about risks that are just emerging in the world that need to be taken into account. And you just draw these codes together and you collect them, you write them down so everybody can see them. And now the team is in a better position to see what might be going wrong. Now, what happens here is that even if a team is enthusiastic about a plan, and they're going to discover possible problems that nobody had mentioned. Maybe because it hadn't occurred to anybody. Maybe because the people who thought about it didn't want to disturb the harmony of the group. And the way this differs from a usual technique where you say, does anybody see a problem? Is if the group has come up with a recommendation, people don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to be the one who's, you know, identifying these kinds of difficulties when everybody else seems so ready to move on. So there's a natural reluctance to speak out. And or even people may not even think about what could go wrong because they're so enthusiastic. And the premortem flips that on its head. And the way you show you're smart is by coming up with interesting and plausible problems that the team needs to think about. And in just about every session that I've run with a premortem, there are discoveries. And the result of the discoveries is that people may modify their strategy. They may build in more hedges. They may, you know, just find other ways to proceed, or they may decide that they don't want to proceed at all, even though they seem so committed earlier. And that's the way the premortem works. I am going to be putting on a 2 half-day workshop on how to do a premortem next week. I'm doing this in connection with Bryce Hoffman, who has written a book about red team procedures. And this is going to take place on June 8th and June 9th between 1 o'clock and 4 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern time. And if anybody wants to get more information, they should contact Bryce. His email is Bryce, B-R-Y-C-E, at redteamthinking, that's all one word, .com. And you can get information about this workshop. And the reason, one reason we're putting on the workshop, even though I've written about the premortem, is we find out that people think that they're putting a premortem into play and they're getting it wrong. They're doing things that get in the way of it being effective. And we've heard this was happening on Wall Street, that the idea of the premortem was popular. And then some people were letting us know that the way the premortems were being carried out were lacking in some important ways. So we thought it was would be very valuable to calibrate with people who want to use a premortem and show them how the premortem works and some common mistakes and traps that they might fall into so that they can do a better job with it.
Okay, thank you for that. And it's a great introduction. And just to repeat, these 2 dates, are they the same events on being repeated on both dates, or are they sequential?
It's sequential. It's a two-part two-part workshop.
So that's, okay. So that's 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern time. Well, for anyone here in the UK, that's 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. UK time. Okay, now that's a wonderful introduction, and you know, thank you so much for talking about the premortem, because it, you know, I've been a huge fan of that. Again, just for anyone listening who's new to the show, I used to work as a trader for 25 years. I now work as a coach, working both with traders but also working with teams and businesses. So on the one hand, it's performance coaching with traders. On the other hand, it's executive coaching and systemic team coaching. And in the work I've done with traders and investment professionals, I've been a big advocate of asking them it's quite hard to do a pre-mortem on your own, but to do what I would call pre-mortem thinking. So before you jump from your analysis and your planning, just put a pause in there and try and do your own pre-mortem. It's something which I've encouraged a lot of people to do, where they think about what could go wrong based on what goes wrong for them historically. What are some of the traits which they picked up? Now, obviously, that's not a normal premortem, but it gives them the chance to check themselves. And I used to do that in my own work as a trader. So I left trading in 2010. But I remember becoming familiar with it. I think you published an article in about 2007, and that resonated with me straight away, because I was already doing something similar. I'd already been working on trying to counter some of my, what was a very typical issue for traders, and what I was particularly susceptible was confirmation bias. So I was trying to turn my analysis on my head. And think, how could I avoid, falling into this trap of confirmation bias? And then when I read about your premortem, I thought, that is something I need to do before I engaged with the ideas I had. And in the first place, it made my analysis a lot more robust, and it made my execution a lot more robust. And the other thing it did for me is it alerted me to issues and problems, which when they came up, I'd already thought about. So it was, I already had an alternative plan of action within that. So whilst that's not what you would call a strict pre-mortem, it was kind of a pre-mortem thinking. And I do encourage my clients now to do something similar when they're going into the action process of their trading or investing. The other thing is I work with teams, and I have run a couple of pre-mortems with teams, and I get people to break up into groups. And again, it's had a fantastic effect. But as I said,
I see the ice cream man's turned up outside.
That's what it sounds like.
29 degrees in London.
So when I've done it with teams, it's been really powerful as well. And it's thrown up problems that they just weren't even aware of. So whilst I don't think it's as robust, the ones I've done, as perhaps the proper pre-mortem that I've read about in your processes, even a kind of less robust version has been incredibly powerful. But I think you said that in your tests, it's more than doubled the success rate of projects that people have been working on. Is that correct?
I don't have the data to support that idea that it's doubled the rate. I would love to believe that.
Right.
But I don't have the data to back that up. But I will say that, you know, the idea of just stepping back, catching your breath and saying what can go wrong can be very useful. But it'd be more useful along the lines of a pre-mortem instead of saying what can go wrong, which is sort of, speculative, is to say it has gone wrong. We don't know what has gone wrong, but we know that this has failed. This has flamed out. And now your job is to use your experience and your intelligence to identify what it was that happened that resulted in this failure. So you see that there's an important shift there between just what can go wrong versus it has gone wrong. This has failed. Now tell me why.
It's great to hear about this pre-mortem. I get this idea of trying to, you know, visualize the potential outcome through this crystal ball gazing rather than asking a binary question. I think that's such great process, I think, for complex decisions. I want to ask though about the state of the people, for example, if you're about to go through that process, you know, the degree of presence a person has and cognitive load a person has when they're about to go through that process, I imagine would make a difference to just how much insight they think about as to what might go wrong in future. So is there any preparation that you encourage people to do before actually going through the process itself of pre-mortem, either as a collective team where, you know, mentally people could be kind of all over the place and not focused in the present moment and thus not being able to collectively think about this process, and at an individual level where perhaps someone might be going through a significant period of stress, and then if they then apply, you know, go into the process of pre-mortem, if they're in a stress state, are they going to get to the same kind of outcomes than if they were in a sort of a calmer state?
Right. So when we do the pre-mortem, part of the exercise is to say, everybody around the table, just take a few deep breaths, just relax, just lean back, just to calm them down so that the level of agitation might be reduced, and just so that they have a stronger connection with whatever associative thinking that might arise for them. So we don't ask people to prepare much in advance other than to learn more about the nature of the plan and the decision that they're making. So the more they're familiar with that, the better the kinds of responses they'll have. And I want to go back to Steve's comments about the data about doubling the success rate. And I'm realizing you probably are referring to a study that we did where we compared the pre-mortem to other kinds of critiquing efforts to see the effect that it had on confidence that of people formed for plans that they were getting ready to put into practice. And the pre-mortem was significantly more effective at reducing the overconfidence that people were experiencing. That's probably the study that you're thinking about, Steve.
Maybe, yeah.
I think that's I think super important, this requirement to get mental clarity before advancing into process. But also, I think, as you bring to light, also the need for good preparation and forewarning of what's on the agenda if it's going to be a meeting about such process. Very often, people bring a meeting together and you sit down and bang, you go into process. And everyone's kind of like, you know, not on the same page. But there are so many meetings that are going on across corporate space that go into a decision-making process of some sort where there's been no sharing of an agenda. It's just like turn up, you know, show up and go. But so it's very good to hear that that is extremely important from your perspective.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with that.
One of the fascinating elements of it, and I remember reading about this in one of your articles, or might not have been yours, but somebody else's article about the pre-mortem. I worked with a team a few years ago, and they were a gas trading team at a large energy firm. And I was working with the entire team, and they just had a huge trading loss that had happened over the course of a couple of months. And I was interviewing the entire team one by one. And I remember one member of the team, who was probably the quietest member of the team, the most introverted one, said to me, you know, I saw that happening. I knew it was going to happen. It was all there. And I said to him, you know, why didn't you say something? He said, no one listens to me anyway.
Steve, that's exactly the point. The pre-mortem provides a forum.
Yeah.
For people who have those reservations, who aren't going to voice them. A pre-mortem is a way for people to get heard, who usually are marginalized. A pre-mortem is particularly a way for, say, some people who are newer to the team, who are unsure of their role, to have a platform for showing off to the others about the kinds of hesitations, the kinds of things that they would be worried about. So it's really it becomes a competition to see who can come up with the most insightful potential problems.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the big problems with this, and I think one of the great things about, from what I've read with the pre-mortem, and again, it's something I've done when I've used them, is I get people to write down their concerns blindly, so that they write them down, and no one is actually identified as the person who came up with the issue, because you have these problems of power plays when you work in groups, in organizations. So no one wants to be the person who called something out if they're identified. But when you do it in a blind sense, when they can post it blindly, write it on something and then almost put them in a box and no one knows who submitted them, then I find that there's a lot more willingness to sort of speak out.
Sort of like a Delphi technique. So I can see the benefits of that. That's not the way I prefer to do it. I prefer to do it where people are saying, speaking out themselves, and we start with the person who's in charge, and that person is going to be describe what is the item at the top of their list. And they have to set the tone, and they're setting a tone for how to be candid and how to trust others by sort of exposing your own worries. And so we start with the most powerful person in the room speaking first to set the tone. And this allows the pre-mortem to become a tool for changing a culture of a team from a culture where people are afraid to speak out, are very guarded, to a culture where people will be more comfortable in expressing their concerns and their hesitations.
Okay, so that requires the approval of the people at the top buying into this process.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. What happens when you don't get that, though, where you go in at perhaps a lower level and there is that power play happening?
Right. I've been in situations like that. I remember two in particular. We did one project, and the person who we were doing a project for somebody, and the person who owned that project, we said we're going to want to do a pre-mortem at the end of this meeting. It was a kickoff meeting for a very large project, and he said, "I hate the idea. I hate the idea because it's going to discourage people. It's going to demoralize them." And so we said, "We think you'll be surprised." And he said, "I think it's a big mistake, but okay, contract is underway. We'll do it reluctantly." And he made his disdain pretty clear. And then we started to do the pre-mortem, and we heard all sorts of things that he had never thought about or heard before on this project. And when it was over, he said, "Thank goodness for the pre-mortem. If we hadn't done it, this project would have failed." And so he became a huge advocate for doing pre-mortems.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Fantastic.
And we did it. I remember doing a pre-mortem for a large company with some of their top staff. And they were very political, as you described. They were very careful about what they would talk about with each other. And the pre-mortem just captured them. And afterwards, people said, "I can't believe what people said in that meeting. This is unlike any meeting we've ever had, the kinds of things that people would bring up." So just the energy of the pre-mortem carries people into a different place than their usual guarded stance.
And the shadow box, could you describe that? Is the pre-mortem part of the shadow box?
No, it's a different technique altogether. Right. Shadowbox is a method that we've been working on for almost 6 years now. And shadowbox is essentially a way to have people see the world through the eyes of experts without the experts being there. So that if you want to get people up to speed more quickly, if you want to disseminate expertise, Shadowbox is a way of doing that. And it's a paper and pencil form, but it's also a digital form, which is coming in extremely valuable these days when you don't have face-to-face training and people want to do training. And so they're calling on us to provide Shadowbox training. And the way Shadowbox works is has a few versions. One of them is a scenario version. So we would make up a scenario, a difficult, challenging scenario, and we'd walk you through it. And you could do this as part of a group, or you could do it on your own. And we could, you know, set up an electronic format for it. And as the scenario unfolds, we'd stop the action and say, "Here we're at a decision point. And at this decision point, here's four options. Rank order which you would do, the one that you're most enthusiastic about to the least, and write down the reasons why you rank them that way." And we get that, and then we go on and we continue, and then we hit another decision point, and we might say, "Here, at this point, here's three goals. Rank order these goals from top to bottom, and write down the reasons why you rank them that way." And then we go on a little more, and then we hit a third decision point. We might say, "Here are five pieces of information. Rank order how important these are for you to inspect it, and write down your reasons for ranking them that way." And you just go on in that vein. And the way it works is we've also had a small panel of 3 to 5 experts go through the same scenario. They've done their ranking, and they've written down their reasons. And so when you're doing your ranking, after you do your ranking, then we say, "Very good. Now let's see what the experts ranked." And you want your ranking to match theirs, and you're trying to be closer to them. But the real learning comes in after you see whether you how well you match them or not, is let's see what the experts wrote. What were they concerned about? What implications were they noticing? And so that's how you get to see the world, at least this scenario, through the eyes of the experts, but the experts aren't there. So they're not a bottleneck, because it's always hard to find experts and to schedule them and things like that. And with Shadowbox, you don't need to do that. And so that's a scenario version, and where it might come into play with investment decision making is organizations have people who are very experienced in various ways, such as judging the worth of a company and judging the prospects for that company, given changing kinds of conditions. And you want, you know, some of your newer people to see how are they making these judgments? How are they applying their expertise? And you could ask them, how do you make the judgments? And they'll give you general answers. And that's like making speeches. But when you pin it down to specific cases with lots of context, then their expertise comes out more vividly. And so that's how Shadowbox could work in this arena as a way of transferring expertise and building a staff.
Fantastic. I wonder if I might like to just go back slightly, if I may, Gary, on this conversation. Naturalistic decision making, that's very aligned to some of the work that I do around building presence and getting back to a state of having a natural self, and that there's huge power in accessing this state that we're kind of born with, where we're tuned in, we're positive, we're resilient, we fall over, we recover quickly, we learn rapidly, and we do that better in a natural state of being. And in that state, we make better decisions under pressure because we're more tuned into the inputs through our senses. And I think that leads me on to this recognition sort of prime decision making that you talk about, that the fire services were engaged with, and recalling patterns of the past and using those to determine best practice for an immediate decision. And some of that relies upon intuition. But my question is, do you think that our general state makes intuition a variable, so that actually we could have an enhanced level of intuition, or actually we could be in the wrong state mentally, where actually we'd have a very low level of intuition, and that there's a way of getting that reset and recalibrated to a way that's optimal, that then makes it easier to go through this process of recognition prime decision making?
That's a great question. So here's what I think is going on. The idea of naturalistic decision making is to try to get out of a laboratory environment and see how people actually make decisions, especially people who are very experienced at, and to see what we can learn from them. And what we found is that they were using their intuition. They were recognizing situations because they had built up a large repertoire of patterns. So for me, intuition isn't a magical sixth sense. It's not like extrasensory perception. It's what your experience buys you, so that you don't have to start from scratch every time you enter a new situation. You have your experience to draw on, and you can draw on it very quickly because it's in the form of the patterns, and you're doing pattern matching. And so intuition is an outgrowth of your expertise and of your experience. And intuition isn't perfect. That's why the RPD model has a second part of doing a mental simulation to see, does this make sense to deliberately assess it in the context of this situation? But so we worry that, you know, intuition certainly is not perfect, and it can sometimes mislead us. And so how do you get intuition to work better for you? How do you improve your intuition? And that's what the Shadowbox method, we think, is enabling people to do, is to build up their expertise, because they're getting more and more repetitions. So they're building up experience that way. Plus, they're getting to learn from the experts what the experts chose, to compare it. Why did the expert do that? I thought this was the right course of action, or I thought this should be my goal, but the experts are saying that no, that's got to be the goal. Let me see what they wrote. Let me see why. And I may disagree with them, because experts aren't always right, but I can learn from them. I mean, they're people that I can at least respect enough to try to see what were they thinking about. And that's how I improve my mental model about how things work. And that's how I can get smarter. And so when that happens, then my intuition becomes more powerful. So Shadowbox is a way of trying to build more powerful intuitions.
That's, yeah, very, very interesting. I mean, I know that I was sort of mentor and a board member of a bank, and she had great difficulty in making big decisions under an awful lot of decisions being on the table, right, with so much clutter going on. And it was mental clarity around better self-management to develop presence that helped her build better intuition to then make decisions in an easier, more comfortable way. And they were more appropriate decisions rather than, you know, decisions that sometimes we make them for the sake of it.
Before we continue with the podcast, a quick word about our podcast partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA is an outstanding member-led organization which promotes high-quality education, training, and research on the discipline and practice of technical analysis. Membership of the STA opens up a multitude of educational programs, including an excellent home study course and diploma programs run at some of the world's leading academic institutions. Membership also brings you access to meetings, webinars, and live events with speakers from the world of trading and investment, and informative articles written by some of the leading figures in the world of technical analysis and financial markets, many of which are produced in their regular newsletter. To find out more about the STA, visit their website page, sta-uk.org, or Google Society of Technical Analysts. Now back to the podcast. Can I just go backwards slightly in time? Because I'm fascinated with the whole field of behavioral finance, and I'm sure quite a lot of people listening to this podcast will have been drawn to listen to this because of the field of behavioral finance and your place within it. I got attracted to behavioral finance when I first read about it, I suppose in the early 2000s, when I first read about the kind of biases and heuristics field, which is obviously the dominant area. As I was reading it, as I was studying it, as I was learning about it, I found myself at a disconnect with it because I found it was lacking something, which was almost like real world application. You could understand it if you moved it backwards, almost to a laboratory type situation. But in everyday work, it wasn't. I found it very hard to apply. Perhaps other than sort of being aware of some aspects, which you had, but even though you were aware of them, they were incredibly hard to change and adjust them. And then I came across your work, which kind of stood as almost in contrast to that sort of. Whereas I would say that intuition and sort of listening to your emotions was quite frowned upon with the other school. Your school, your field of naturalistic decision making, actually embraced them. And I felt that's what people that I met and I knew, and I did myself in the financial markets, that's what we did when people said, you can't succeed like that. But there were people around me every day succeeding like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think you've characterized it extremely well, and I have great respect for the researchers in the heuristics and biases community. I know a number of them, and I truly am awed by their brilliance and their creativity. So I don't want to take anything away from them, except I don't align with that approach. I'm uncomfortable with an approach that has usually a fair amount of negativity around expertise, and that doesn't factor in to most of their work. Sometimes it does, but usually it doesn't. And you know, you show somebody an expert, and they're looking at reasons why the person really doesn't know what they're talking about, and they're horribly biased. And I think the biases research has come up with lots of interesting results, many of them in laboratory situations with college students given tasks they've never seen before. So there's no expertise at all going on. And that's done deliberately. because you don't want people to come into a study where they're going to be given tasks that they have some familiarity with, because they'll have different amounts of familiarity, and that's going to create more variability in your results. And the more variability in your results, the higher the error terms are going to be, the harder it is to get statistical significance, and it goes downhill from there. And so they've said, okay, we can control the amount of experience. We'll make it zero. We're going to give people tasks they've never seen before. So everybody starts in the same place. But that means you're studying people who are novices at these tasks. And I remember once having a conversation with someone who said, but I give my subjects lots of practice. I give them 10 hours of practice. And I thought, 10 hours of practice on an artificial task without any context versus firefighters, the ones we've been studying, had 20 years of experience. 10 hours, 20 years, please. It's not even close to being the same sort of thing. I think the heuristics that we have are very powerful. And the heuristics and biases community sort of knows this. They know that these heuristics are valuable. But it's easier to do the research if you set up conditions where the heuristics can mislead you. And so that's the way the research has been done. And that's why the heuristics have been given, you know, such a negative connotation. But I look at these heuristics and I say, they're powerful heuristics. They're valuable. There's a positive part of the heuristics that never gets studied. And I think that's unfortunate. Because I think it gives us a biased view of heuristics and biases. And I've made this offer to some people in the heuristics and biases community. I've offered to pay for this surgery because we know from the work of Damasio that there's a part of the brain, I forget the specific brain structure, where there's the connection between emotion and decision making. And we know that because people who have lesions in this part of the brain turn into Mr. Spock, and they only make decisions, you know, purely on logical grounds without any emotion whatsoever. But unlike Mr. Spock, they lead miserable lives. They take forever to make trivial decisions because they have no emotional basis. They lose their jobs. Their intelligence is unaffected. They're just as smart as they were before, but they're just ineffective. They get divorced. It's really a horrible affliction. But if you really are worried that your emotions are going to bias you, then I've said, we can burn out, we can lesion this area of your brain and keep your decision-making protected from your emotions. And we can do it without having to even operate. We can use lasers to sort of triangulate on this one area. And I said, I will pay for this surgery if anybody is willing to undergo it. You know something? No one has ever agreed to be part of this project, but I'm still hopeful.
That's a great story. Listen, where I saw this really, I've seen this with clients I work with. So obviously I work with traders from very long-term portfolio management types running large risks, investment type structures, to day traders who are going in and out the market super quick. And people say, well, you can't do that because algos and computer systems are doing it, you know, almost infinitely faster than a human can watch the market and make choices. And yet I see people doing this day in, day out and succeeding. And there's two examples from my client base over the years where I've seen this dramatically. So I was working with an individual in a bank a few years ago who was trading foreign exchange, and he was trading this triangle of currencies where there was a mathematical equation between these three currencies that basically it was impossible to arbitrage them. If two got out of line, the other one, which was a result of the other two, automatically adjusted in micro milliseconds. You know, the computers would straight away capture in on that. And I asked this individual when I got to know him, you know, how are you trading? And he told me he's manually capturing the differences in these three currencies. And at first I thought, well, that's impossible. And you've kind of furrowed your eyes of your brain as you said that. And that's exactly what I thought. I said, well, no one's done that since the 1990s when people were able to be programmed to do this. And he said, well, that's what I do. And he was incredibly successful at it. And he'd done it for years. Now, I worked with this individual over 6 months, meeting him once a month. And as I got to know him and explore his process with him, I realized that he was using intuition. It was almost like he was doing a recognized, primed decision-making, spotting a setup, a pattern that was repeating itself time and time again. And he could observe that just by trading on two of the currencies and leaving the third one for a fraction of a second. So it wasn't pure arbitrage in that sense. He wasn't doing what the algos were doing. But his intuition was, he'd done it for so many years. He was able to identify what was about to happen before it happened.
So there's one part of it is he was able to respond so quickly, but the other part that you just mentioned is he was anticipating.
Yes.
So he was, you know, even before it happened, he was getting ready for it to happen.
Yeah.
So let me ask you about another technique that we've been playing around with. I don't know if it'd be relevant to investment decision making and portfolio managers. Let me just describe it and see what your thoughts are. It has to do with artificial intelligence.
Right.
And we see in lots of situations, artificial intelligence is gaining more and more prominence as a tool for decision making and for recommendations. And we're doing a project for DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, on how to make artificial intelligence more explainable. And we're a small part of a much larger program. There's 11 teams that are working on this, and we're looking at the psychological aspects of it. And we've come up with this idea that's not an artificial intelligence tool, but it's a set of tools that are designed to help people understand artificial intelligence better, not generally, but to understand a specific AI system so that they can see how it works and how it doesn't work. And we call this AIQ, which stands for Artificial Intelligence Quotient. And it's a way of making people smarter about smart machines. And the techniques, there's a variety of different methods, and they're all very low tech, but they're all aimed at helping people who have to interact with a specific artificial intelligence system, regardless of what it is, to be able to get a better sense of how does it work and how does it not work and where does it fail? What are the boundary conditions? And where it doesn't work, to diagnose, to have a sense of why it doesn't work there. And then have some idea about how to do workarounds. So the techniques are really to help people engage with whatever AI system that they're using so that they can use it more powerfully and effectively. Is this relevant to the world of portfolio management and investment decision making?
Yeah, I think so, because I mean it sounds like sense making.
In many ways it is, right? Yes.
Whatever's being thrown at you, you build up some sort of sense or understanding of it based on your previous patterns, I guess. Which to me that kind of captures the very essence of great investment and great trading and great portfolio construction and great management. It's that ability to sense whatever the environment is giving you new situations almost on a daily basis. You know, God, we've seen that this year more than ever. You know, and what great traders do, great investors do, is they're able to make sense of it so much quicker because they recognize something. They don't know exactly what's happening, but there's something that stirred their interest and their curiosity that they're going to explore.
Right. But and now if you sort of require them to use artificial intelligence tools, will those tools get in the way of their experience? Will those tools get in the way of their intuitions? Or will they be able to assimilate those tools because they understand how the tools work and where the limitations of the tools are, so that they can really use it as a tool rather than be become enslaved to the tool and enslaved to recommendations that they don't fully understand.
Yeah. Can I just come in here on that? It's very, very interesting because one part of the market, gamification is going on. So people are accessing market environments, perhaps sort of never actually been in markets before, but they're accessing it through trading boutiques and trading mechanisms that very often are them approaching trading as if it was a game. And there's going to be some people coding to market APIs to trade the market in a way that perhaps our generation that have gone up through the last 30, 40 years have never used those techniques. But I think the world, as it's maturing into trading and the use of artificial intelligence, is looking at the market as though it's a game. And a different sort of mindset is required for that. And I think this the approach that you're talking about and having an intelligence around AI, and I guess a fluid intelligence, given the type of environment that we're talking about, would be a very, very beneficial process.
Okay, I just wanted to check that out with you.
That's super cool. I think it fits very well.
Can I give you a thought on that? Because I would say yes for younger people who are more
open. Yeah, sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Whereas older people, possibly a bit challenged by it. I mean, I would include myself amongst that. I know a lot of younger traders in their 20s and early 30s using AI systems as an aid because they're not afraid of them and they understand how they can assist them, but they don't fully understand the system itself, but they're very comfortable using it almost because they trust it and they can see the value it brings. Whereas some of the older individuals I know, they're still relying on older methods that they trust and perhaps aren't quite ready to make that leap. It's perhaps beyond, except for maybe a few of them who are, really curious about this, perhaps more creative. Generally, they would probably abhor it because it's so alien to them.
Okay, so I have two reactions to that. First of all, for the people who are relying heavily on AI, sounds like, in many cases, they may be using the AI as a substitute for expertise and for experience. And so it feels like a way to try to gain a certain amount of capability without having to spend the years of mastering the craft. And that makes me uncomfortable because I'm not advocating for an uncritical use of AI, and I don't think AI is a good substitute for the experience that you two gentlemen have acquired. And there is usually or almost always aspects of the context that are not included in the AI system or represented in the AI system. So that makes it dangerous to become overly reliant on the AI systems that we have to offer. So that's the first reaction. The second reaction is this AIQ approach may be well designed for the more experienced gentlemen, such as the two of you, who aren't as comfortable with the technology, to help you get a better sense of where the strengths and limitations of the technology are. So you can take advantage of what the technology is offering you, but you don't have to put yourself at risk of being trapped by some of the blind alleys that the technology can lead you down.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of one individual in particular who I know who's created his own trading system that has AI capability. But his father is a CTO and is very comfortable with AI at a very large firm. And his father has built the technology platform for him. So he's created the ideas and the concept. And father's taken it to another level and added an AI capability and then kind of explained it to his son, who's in his early 30s. Said this can really help improve the quality of of how your system operates, and it has done, and between them, so that's almost a great example where you're describing that, where there is a trust because you have someone who's used to using it. But in a sense, what I'm hearing is it would almost, am I correct, they would fill that gap in that last example?
I think that's what the idea is, to try to fill that gap. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it sounds like it's fascinating. And it's an incredible journey that the industry is on with it, with AI. Sorry, Mark.
I was going to say that both Steve and I know of cases across the industry where if you're reliant on the IT department, even that's embedded within an investment banking business, to create a product for the front office to trade, the number of times that's totally failing because the people in the IT building these things don't know, they haven't been through the journey of the business of trading. And so they're writing this code that they believe from an IT perspective is doing what it's meant to do, but there's a translation gap somewhere between what the front office have desired and what the IT people have produced. Huge challenges in that space.
So we've been observing that exact phenomenon for decades now. And I think from my perspective, what happens is you have really bright young people going through college and getting excited about IT and taking classes in it and getting degrees in it. And they're given challenging problems, you know, very complex analytical problems that they can handle. And so they love working on those kinds of problems. And then they go out and start working for companies, and they expect that they're going to be given the same kind of environment where people bring them analytical problems to solve and to code around and to work on. And they're not really prepared to go and talk to people, to go away from their desk and to talk with some of the traders and to try to understand and to create a dialogue. And we've worked with companies, and there are some people who do a good job of crossing back and forth. And we say, these are the people who should interface with your internal customers because they're really good at it. Then there are other people whose idea, they say, those people over there, they don't know anything about coding or any of those things. And they just have total contempt for the people who are actually doing the work and making the money for the firm. And they say, they'll bring us a problem and I'll work on it for a month or two and I'll bring them back a solution. And they'll say, no, that really doesn't give me what I want. Well, why didn't you tell me what you wanted? And so they'll get angry. And so there's all this conflict going on. And we say to the firms, people like that, try to keep them away from the customers, okay, the internal customers, because it's not going to go well. They're not prepared to have a meaningful dialogue. Maybe they can be helped to do so. Maybe they can be helped. But the only way this is going to work is if you have the dialogue between the people who are building the powerful analytical tools and the people who are going to be applying the tools, who are doing the work, who have to be aware of the context of the work and the kinds of variables that have to be taken into account. Those community, the tools have to be built as a dialogue between those two communities. And in many cases, as you pointed out, Mark, it simply is not happening. And it may not be happening just because of temperament, the temperament of people who go into the tool building activity, and as different from the people who are on the other side, who like the interaction with customers and enjoy just reading people's responses and getting a sense of whether they have a reasonable path forward or not.
Do you know what? It's fascinating hearing that, because I hear so much of, you know, of what's coming out there, of what both myself and Mark see, where we see all these people with this fantastic intellect and these hard analytical skills, but they're lacking the soft skills. And intuition is one of the soft skills, which I always talk about with people as really being a hard skill. You know, 20 years at the coalface, developing that ability and that skill, you know. And again, I go back to that fires, the fireman story you talked about in Sources of Power. And if anyone wants to, you know, just to mention that, it's a brilliant book, and it really, you know, it talks about your early work in that field. I'd love you just to explain that for the audience, of that story of that fireman who was dealing with the fire. And the floor collapsed, and he got his team out. And you were analyzing them to try and understand his thought processes. I love that story.
Okay, I'll tell you. The story has been, other people have written about it in other books. Malcolm Gladwell has written about it and many others. But here's what, this was maybe one of the first interviews we did with firefighters. And I had 2 hours blocked to talk to this person about tough decisions. And we sat down, and he was agreeable. And I said, okay, the way we're going to do the interview, I want to have an experience where you made a tough decision. And he said, I've got just the one to tell you about. And I said, great. And he said, it happened 14 years earlier. And I said, oh, that's like a lifetime ago. Do you have anything more recent than 14 years? And he said, no, this was a time when, and I made this decision because I have extrasensory perception. And that's how I made the decision. And my heart sank. I don't want to talk about extrasensory perception, about an incident that happened 14 years earlier. And I said, can you tell me about, do you have any other tough decisions you've made in the intervening 14 years? And he said, nope, that's the only one. And that's the only one he wanted to talk about. So I said, okay, well, I've got you booked for 2 hours. You know, let's see what's going on. And he said, yep, it was extrasensory perception, ESP, that saved the day. It was a simple house fire. I was, a young firefighter then. I was in charge of a crew. And we looked at it, and it looked like the fire was coming out of the back of the house. And I figured, it's a kitchen fire, you know, piece of cake. We know what to do. We bring the hose into the house. We hit the hose with the water. Fire goes out. We're heroes, and everything is fine. So that's what we do. We go into the house, through the living room, into the back with the kitchen where we see the smoke seems to be coming out, hit what we think is the base of the fire with the water, turn off the water, and then the fire comes back. And then we said, that's strange. So we hit it again, and then we ease up, and the fire comes back. That's really bizarre. And I said, and then what'd you do? He said, well, we said, let's retreat back into the living room and figure this out, because, you know, something's going on here. Now, he did not know that there was a basement in this house, and he did not know that the fire was in the basement. But he just knew that his first approach had failed. So they retreat back into the living room. And he said, then ESP hit me, and I told my crew, everybody get out of here. And we all left. And as we were leaving, people were jumping out of windows. The floor collapsed right where we had been standing. And if we had stayed there another minute, we would have dropped right into the fire, and we would have been horribly burned. Some of us might have died, and it was ESP. So I said, okay, and I'm writing this down, even though I can't believe I'm writing this down. And I say, tell me what you were noticing. And he said, so we're in the living room, and he said, it was really hot, much hotter than it should have been. And he said, at that time, we didn't have any thermal devices, so I always left my ear flaps open so I could get a sense of the heat, and it was surprisingly hot. And I said, okay, and I wrote that down. And I said, what else were you noticing? And he said, it was really quiet, because fires are noisy, but I wasn't hearing the kind of noise I would associate with a fire that was going to generate that much heat. And now, in retrospect, the reason it was he wasn't getting much noise was the floor was the baffle that was shielding them from the noise. So I said, so let's put this together. You thought it was going to be a simple kitchen fire that you could put out, and it wasn't that. And you retreat, and now you're getting all this strange information about hotter than you think it is, and quieter than it should be. And none of this is making sense. And That's why you told your crew to leave, isn't it? Because this wasn't matching any of the patterns you had ever built up. And he said, yeah, I guess that was it. And he realized he didn't have ESP. What he had was expertise. But he had been living for the last 14 years thinking that he was protected by ESP, and he was living in a fool's paradise. He was not happy with that interview. I was delighted with the interview because it showed the power of intuition to match patterns, or when there's not a pattern matching, to say, I don't know what's going on and it's too dangerous and we need to reassess in a safe place because we're not safe here anymore.
And that is what I see all the time with great traders. Disconnects, connections, patterns, and why they can do something on a situation they've never seen before.
Right, right. And is this plausible? Is this making sense?
Yeah.
Or this is not making sense, and I'm in a situation that's not safe.
Yeah, yeah.
Welcome to 2020.
Yes, indeed. Yes.
Absolutely. We all need some of this.
Well, listen, I've really enjoyed this. I think we need to start sort of winding it down, but I could talk for hours to you. I could listen to you for hours. It's been great. Do you want to just give a quick plug again to remind people of the webcast you've got coming up and where they can find out more about you?
Right. Okay. So the webcast is a masterclass on pre-mortem. And it's with me, Gary Klein, and with Bryce Hoffman. And it's taking place next week, June 8th and June 9th, 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern Time. And to get more information, go to just contact Bryce directly at Bryce, B-R-Y-C-E, that's his first name, at redteamthinking, all one word, .com. And so that's how to find more information about this this workshop, and we'll be doing it online. To find out more about me, you should go to the website www.shadowboxtraining, all one word, .com, and you'll learn about our shadow box approach. I have my own website, Gary-Klein, .com. And I have, I guess people might want to get in touch with me they might want to follow me on Twitter. And there, my Twitter handle is Kleinsight, KLEINSIGHT.
Okay. All right. Okay. Lovely. Mark, do you want to just, perhaps we'll leave you to take out to close us down.
Sure. Well, Dr. Gary Klein, it's been an absolute pleasure hearing your journey, your stories, the toolkit that you've built up that's been so valuable for many types of people that as we enter and travel through 2020, a lot of us are going to be able to resonate with the power and this whole process about making decisions under pressure and the need to have something to guide you through important decisions when they're required. I've enjoyed this conversation enormously, and we wish you well, and thanks for all the work you've done, and we're happy to support you in the future if required. And we can only wish that you stay safe and stay well, Gary. So many thanks indeed.
Great. Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I really appreciate the conversation with the two of you. I mean, you're two lovely gentlemen to have to spend an hour with. Thank you. And same for both of you. Stay safe. Stay healthy.
Thank you once again to Dr. Klein. That was an outstanding podcast. I'm sure you're all going to agree with me on that one. Also, thank you very quickly to the Society of Technical Analysts, our podcast partner, the STA. You can find out more about them if you go to their website, sta-uk.org. They're a fantastic organization Membership is not expensive, and it opens up a world of fantastic resources for traders about technical analysis and financial markets. Don't worry if you missed some of the details of the course or program Dr. Klein mentioned. We will be posting them on the show notes on our blog, the Alpha Mind blog. You can find that at alphamindblog.blogspot.com or just Google Alpha Mind blog. We'll also put them in the show notes on the various podcast sites. Also, feel free to check out our own services, including our Alpha Mind coaching program, which again, details are there on the Alpha Mind blog, or just DM me at alphamind101 on Twitter and drop me your email address and we can send you some details about that. Also, please sign up for our newsletter. It hasn't started yet, but it's coming up soon. You can find a link on the right-hand side of our blog page, and we'll be coming up with more details about that soon. It will be a regular newsletter with lots of articles and features about the mindset psychology of trading and trading performance. Thank you once again on behalf of Mark Randall and myself for listening today. We would be delighted to connect with you on LinkedIn as well, Mark Randall and Stephen Goldstein. And we look forward to you joining us on next week's podcast. Thank you very much. Stay safe and good trading.